Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 259. It's Monday, June 3rd. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's start first up with a story from the age of polycrisis, many crises at once, this from Reuters. World Health Organization emergencies teams faces funding crunch as health crises multiply. The World Health Organization's emergencies department is facing, quote, existential threats as multiplying health crises have left it so short of cash that it needed emergency funds to pay staff salaries at the end of last year, an independent report said. In 2023, the department responded to 72 emergencies. They included earthquakes in Turkey and Syria, conflict in Sudan, Ukraine, and Gaza, and a large global cholera outbreak. Without increased capacity in countries, the WHO's emergencies program will be obliged to cut back critical activities, the report adds. Last year, while the WHO's overall budget was relatively well-funded, the emergencies program had a critical funding gap of $411 million, or around a third of its entire budget, the report said. So, of course, having a deficiency of a third of your budget is rather large, although I would point out that we're only talking like $411 million. That doesn't seem like very much when you're talking about global health, but of course, the low priority that public health, and particularly global public health, has, sad. So, unfortunately, we may be stretched even thinner in global public health in years to come. Maybe that can change. Let's make it so. Next up, from Associated Press, daily marijuana use outpaces daily drinking in the U.S., a new study says. Millions of people in the U.S. report using marijuana daily or nearly every day, and those people now outnumber those who say they are daily or nearly daily drinkers of alcohol, according to a study by Carnegie Mellon University. For the first time, the number of Americans who use marijuana just about every day has surpassed the number who drink that often, a shift some 40 years in the making, as recreational pot has become more mainstream and legal in nearly half of U.S. states. In 2022, an estimated 17.7 million people reported using marijuana daily or nearly daily, compared to 14.7 million daily or near daily drinkers, according to an analysis of national survey data. In 1992, when daily pot use hit a low point, less than 1 million people said they use marijuana nearly every day. Alcohol is still more widely used, but 2022 was the first time this intensive level of marijuana use overtook daily or near daily drinking, said the study's author, Jonathan Kalkus, a cannabis policy researcher at Carnegie Mellon University. A good 40% of current cannabis users are using it daily or near daily, a pattern that is more associated with tobacco use than typical alcohol use, Kalkin said. And of course, the effect of this large trend, we're still waiting to see exactly what that happens. One of the things I'm concerned about is, of course, driving under the influence is not well defined and well studied for cannabis use. We have seen increases in motor vehicle injuries related to marijuana use, but this is not very well tracked. And of course, heavy marijuana use that reaches the point of a substance use disorder diagnosis is also increased as marijuana use has risen. Okay, well, next up we have a story on a much more common addiction. That would be nicotine, and it looks like the nicotine pushers are coming up with new ways. This from Reuters. Nicotine-like chemicals in U.S. vapes may be more potent than nicotine, FDA says. Nicotine alternatives used in vapes being launched in the U.S. and abroad, such as 6-methyl nicotine, may be more potent and addictive than nicotine itself, though the scientific data remains incomplete, according to the U.S. FDA and independent researchers. The synthetic substances, which have a chemical structure similar to that of nicotine, are not subject to the U.S. tobacco and vaping regulations that are designed to control traditional nicotine, a highly addictive drug. That means manufacturers can sell vapes containing synthetic nicotine analogs, such as 6-methyl nicotine, in the United States without seeking authorization from the FDA, a process that can be costly, time-consuming, and is often unsuccessful. In response to Reuters' questions about 6-methyl nicotine and other nicotine alternatives, the FDA said in a statement, quote, "Although more research is needed, some emerging data shows these nicotine analogs may be more potent than nicotine, which is already highly addictive, can alter adolescent brain development, and have long-term effects on youth's attention, learning, and memory." Traditional nicotine found in many vapes and pouches is extracted from tobacco leaves. 6-methyl nicotine, in contrast, is made entirely in the lab using chemicals. The FDA said it was considering the use of such synthetic compounds from a, quote, agency-wide perspective, and would use all of its resources to protect youth from products that may harm their health. As well as tobacco products, the FDA also regulates drugs, foods, cosmetics, and more to ensure safety and efficacy. The FDA is a data-driven agency, and we're in the process of reviewing the available data to inform potential actions in this space, it said in response to Reuters' questions. The limitations of existing research included that some papers were industry-funded, while others focused on the short-term impact of on animals or cells and were insufficient to understand 6-methyl nicotine's effect on human bodies, the researchers said. The FDA has yet to approve any flavored vape using traditional nicotine for sale in the United States, saying companies have not been able to show that the health benefits they offer to smokers outweigh the known risk to young people who may be more attracted by the flavors. And of course, the point is not necessarily that these nicotine alternatives are more addictive or more dangerous in some way. If they're even in the same ballpark, the bigger story is that it's a way to avoid regulation by the FDA. Because even if it's in the same ballpark, that would just be a whole unregulated ballpark in nicotine and the products that it's used in, where you have, vaping or just tobacco for that matter, can be very dangerous to one's health and a public health issue of a grand scale. Okay, well, next up we have a story that gets at the fact that addiction takes many forms. Looks many different ways, and it actually happens in older folks. And we see that Medicare actually doesn't cover addiction treatment. So here's a story regarding that from Stat News. Congress closed Medicare's dangerous gaps in coverage for addiction treatment. While many people immediately picture young adults when thinking about the current addiction and overdose epidemic, this crisis is affecting all generations. In fact, more than 7 million older Americans struggle with substance use disorders. Opioid use disorder in particular has skyrocketed among Medicare beneficiaries, with opioid overdose death rates rising higher among people age 65 and older than in any other age group. Yet Medicare does not cover non-hospital-based residential treatment for substance use disorders or outpatient treatment in many community-based treatment facilities, nor does it provide adequate coverage for services delivered by the full range of providers who make up a significant part of the substance use disorder and mental health care workforces. That leaves many Medicare beneficiaries without access to life-saving addiction treatment services. These coverage gaps stand in stark contrast to what is generally covered under Medicaid. All state Medicaid programs cover community-based substance use disorders, treatment facilities, and at least 38 states and the District of Columbia cover at least one level of residential substance use disorder treatment. These gaps persist despite the goals set by the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act passed in 2008. Under this law, the standards of health insurance plans for substance use and mental health benefits must be comparable to and no more restrictive than the standards for other medical or surgical benefits. But nearly two decades after this historic legislation was passed, millions of Americans covered by Medicare continue to face unnecessary and discriminatory barriers to addiction care. Why? Because Medicare is not subject to this landmark civil rights law. Medicare's failure to fully cover addiction care costs lives, is discriminatory, and needs to change. Substance use disorders are treated along a continuum of care, just like many other chronic health conditions. People with the most acute needs often receive inpatient care at a hospital, while those with the least acute needs receive outpatient counseling in office-based settings or community-based treatment programs. In between, there are intermediate levels of care, including intensive outpatient treatment, partial hospitalization programs, and residential treatment services that provide a structured mix of medical care, psychoeducation, and psychotherapy. There are also effective medications approved by the FDA to treat opioid, tobacco, and alcohol use disorders. The course and length of treatment vary based on the specific needs of the individual. A 2022 report from the Legal Action Center, which one of the authors leads, shows that a modest federal investment in Medicare, approximately 0.04% of the total Medicare budget, would help tens of thousands of beneficiaries with substance use disorders access residential treatment each year. This funding would reduce unnecessary hospitalizations and support more opportunities for recovery, ultimately reducing overall costs to the Medicare program. And there are plans underway to introduce legislation to create a new Medicare Part A benefit for residential addiction treatment programs that meet nationally recognized standards set by the American Society of Addiction Medicine. With many Medicare beneficiaries living on fixed incomes, this legislation would ensure they do not have to forego medically necessary treatment because they can't pay the costs entirely out of pocket. There's no reason that Medicare should be using inadequate standards that lag behind other health care plans. Older adults and individuals with chronic disabilities deserve robust health insurance coverage that includes treatment for addiction and mental health conditions. Hear, hear. Okay, next up, also dealing with mental health conditions and moving to a younger population, this from Medical Express, PTSD and anxiety is rising among college students. America's college students seem to be more stressed than ever, with a new report finding a sharp rise in cases of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and acute stress disorder, ASD, on campuses across the country. The findings were published in the journal JAMA Network Open. Any number of events, campus shooting, sexual assault, physical violence, and natural disasters, for example, can trigger either PTSD or acute stress disorder. PTSD can lead to more persistent symptoms, while acute stress disorder's impact may be more transient, anywhere from a few days to a month. Researchers focused on 2017 through 2022, a period marked by escalated societal stressors and global health crises, including, of course, the pandemic. They looked at data from the ongoing Healthy Mind Study, which tracks the mental health of over 392,000 people attending 332 different colleges and universities across the United States. PTSD rates rose from 3.4% of participants in 2017 and 18 to 7.5% by 2021-2022, and acute stress disorders rose from 0.2% to 0.7% over the same period. So, wow, that PTSD one more than doubled from 3.4% to 7.5%, and over tripling for the acute stress disorders. Yikes. Okay, well, next story, I want to back up a little bit and take a bigger look at the power of our mind. This story from CNN, placebos can improve mental health symptoms, study finds. When you're trying to address mental health symptoms, simply the belief that you can be helped may be an important factor. Symptoms of 9 mental health disorders substantially improved under placebo treatment, according to a new review of 90 randomized controlled trials, known as a meta-analysis, totaling almost 10,000 participants, largely in their 30s and 40s. That mental health symptoms improved with placebo treatment may be due to a few potential influences, experts said. First is the placebo effect in the strictest sense, that is the induction of hope and belief in an effective treatment. Placebo is administered in randomized double-blind studies, so participants do not know if they might receive an active drug. Secondly, the benefit of mental health professionals inquiring about a patient's condition is one of the most powerful effects in all of medicine, said Dr. Richard Keefe, professor emeritus of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and psychology and neuroscience at Duke University Medical Center. Belief that things can get better can be healing, added Keefe, who wasn't involved in this study. The findings may also reflect the natural courses of some disorders, experts said. It is well known that mental disorders are episodic, and symptoms may fluctuate over time, and a portion of people may improve partially or completely without any treatment, placebo, or intervention, said Dr. Felipe Bruto Schuch, an adjunct professor of psychiatry and mental health at Brazil's Federal University. This is what we call spontaneous remission. He wasn't involved in the study. The likelihood of spontaneous remission is especially true for depression and anxiety, which have the highest rates of spontaneous remission in general, and were the two disorders to benefit the most from placebo treatment in this study, experts said. A major limitation is that, for methodological reasons, we cannot separate the three main influences mentioned above. Isolating the extent of the true placebo effect would require studies that include a group receiving no medication, not even a placebo, alongside the placebo arm. Such studies are virtually unavailable in the psychiatric field. So, of course, good studies should have placebos, but even then, defining what the placebo is, it's basically everything other than the active medication that's being tested. That includes the clinical experience. If somebody's inquiring or showing you care, that can affect, for instance, your mental health conditions. Not surprisingly, being in a caring environment is good for us. That also can be part of the so-called placebo effect. Okay, well, next up, I also want to take a big picture story here that really gets at epigenetic changes. So epigenetic changes are those that in the epigenetic material, which is surrounding our DNA, the DNA is sort of the hardware, and the epigenetic material is a lot of material that proteins that regulate how these genes are expressed. And this epigenetic material actually is the regulation of that, whether high or low, can be transmitted from one generation to another. So this is actually kind of quick evolution. It can be passed intergenerationally, actually very quickly, in one generation and extend for 2, 3, 4 or more generations. So it's another way that we adapt and change to our environment and the conditions in which we live. So this, from Medical Express, improved nutrition, sanitation linked to beneficial changes in child stress and epigenetic programming. We're increasingly aware of how environmental factors influence a child's early development and health trajectory. We've mostly learned this through research involving direct observations of how ambient conditions like air pollution or a lack of nutritious food affect how our genes function, and over time, what diseases we might develop. However, a new study led by global health researchers at UC Santa Cruz provides some of the clearest and most comprehensive evidence to date on what is known about stress physiology and, quote, epigenetic programming. In a large-scale, randomized controlled trial conducted in rural Bangladesh, the research team found that an integrated intervention that included drinking water, sanitation, hand washing, and nutrition affected the set point, reactivity, and regulation of the physiological stress system in early childhood. The findings, published in Nature Communications, detail how the health interventions had measurable effects on the children in the study at the genetic level, including enhanced functioning of their stress response system, reduced oxidative stress in the body, and reduced methylation levels of their DNA, which is a good thing. Oxidative stress can damage cells, proteins, and DNA, which can contribute to aging and lead to diseases such as diabetes, cancer, and Alzheimer's. Methylation is a chemical modification of DNA or other molecules often triggered by environmental conditions that may persist as cells divide. This study is also more relevant on a global scale because of the trial's location in a low-resource region. Many previous studies were conducted in high-income countries like the United States or UK, where access to safe drinking water, sanitation, and hygiene is relatively high in comparison with the rest of the world. This is really representative of the conditions of that of a majority of the world's population. When this type of research is done in high-income countries, you're not really capturing all these important stressors that could affect a child. What also sets this study apart from others in the literature is the use of physical interventions to improve stress physiology in young children in a low-resource context, instead of psychosocial measures like behavioral therapy or parental coaching. By introducing safe drinking water, nutrition, sanitation, hygiene, and improved nutrition, and showing precisely when and how they change a child's physiology, those measures might be easier for a government to introduce than psychosocial interventions. Combining these physical interventions with psychosocial interventions could achieve even greater health benefits. So, another mechanism by which large social determinants, like safe drinking water, improved nutrition and sanitation, can actually, in this case, improve the stress response of children. Very good. And speaking of changes that's happened over generation, this from Stat News. The new menstruation. Girls are getting their periods earlier and less regularly. Menstruation is a critical indicator of health. Whether and when someone with a uterus gets their period for the first time and throughout their life can reflect not only their reproductive health, but their risk of cardiovascular disease, cancer, miscarriage, and premature death. That also makes menstruation a useful measure of population health, and digital tools for clinical research are beginning to shed light on just how significantly periods are changing over time. A study published in JAMA Network Open, based on data from more than 71,000 women collected through the Apple Research app, shows that girls in the United States have been getting their first period earlier and earlier over the last 55 years, and it has taken longer for their periods to become regular, pointing to worsening overall reproductive and population health. The research is part of the large Apple Women's Health Study, launched in 2019 and conducted with the National Institutes of Health and Harvard School of Public Health. They found the average age of menarche, when an individual gets their first period, decreased from 12 and a half years in 1950 in the period 1950 to 1969 to 11.9 years in the period 2000 to 2005. In the same period, the percentage of people who experience early menarche, that is before age 11, increased from 8.6% to 15.5%, and the percentage of those having very early menarche, that is before the age of 9, more than doubled from 0.6% to 1.4%. Among the 62,000 participants who shared data on cycle regularity, the percentage whose cycles became regular within 2 years of menarche decreased from 74% to 56% between that two time periods of 1950 to 1969 to the period of 2000 to 2005. Both early menarche and irregular cycles are associated with health issues. An early first period is associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease, cancer, and early death, typically connected to increased exposure to estrogen. And a longer window to reach cycle stability in the early years is associated with increased chances of irregular cycles during the rest of reproductive life, which can be a cause of infertility. It's not clear exactly why the experience of menstruation is changing so much. The determinants of menarche and the pubertal transition are multifactorial, wrote study co-author Shruthi Mahalingayya, an assistant professor of environmental, reproductive, and women's health at Harvard. They can be related to body composition, diet, physical activity, and stress, along with environmental exposures to endocrine-disrupting chemicals and air pollutants. But the study does offer clues. About 10,000 participants provided data on their body mass index, and the analysis estimated that about 46% of the drop in age of menarche could be explained by higher body mass index, in part because puberty is dependent on accumulation of sufficient body fat. Another concern is stress and the effect of stress on early puberty and earlier menarche. For example, during COVID-19, stress was associated with a younger age of puberty. Stress could also be driven by environmental factors like financial instability or racism. In the study, racial and ethnic minority groups and people of lower socioeconomic status were most likely to experience cycle irregularity and a reduction in the age of first menstruation. Early menarche could also be a cause of further stress down the line. With more girls going through puberty earlier, it might make it more comfortable for those experiencing. But on the other hand, in general, girls who go through puberty earlier are at increased risk of sexual abuse because they look very mature, but they're immature. Menstrual health and women's health is understood and underfunded. We need significantly greater investment in early counseling, education around menstrual health as a vital sign, and individualized healthcare plans. Okay, well, next up, it's been long enough since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic that we can take a full three-year analysis of what the effect is over multiple years. This from Medical Express. New findings show risk of death from COVID-19 lessens, but infection can still cause issues 3 years later. The research published in Nature Medicine tracked the virus's health effects on people 3 years after being infected with the original strain of COVID-19 in 2020. That year, about 20 million people tested positive for the virus in the U.S. The new study assessed the risk of death and 80 adverse health conditions in people 3 years after being diagnosed with COVID-19. In the third year after infection, COVID-19 patients who had been hospitalized experienced a 34% elevated health risk across all organ systems compared to people who did not have COVID-19. That number is down from a 182% increase at 1 year after COVID infection and a 57% risk 2 years after. Among non-hospitalized patients, researchers found a 5% increase of suffering from long COVID in the third year after infection. This translates into 41 more health problems per 1,000 persons, a small but not trivial burden. The long-term health effects in the third year primarily affected the GI, pulmonary, and neurological systems. By comparison, the risk was increased by 23% 1 year after infection and increased by 16% 2 years after. In the analysis, researchers also measured and compared the number of healthy life years lost due to COVID-19. They found that among the non-hospitalized, at 3 years after infection, COVID-19 had contributed to 10 lost years of healthy life per 1,000 persons. By comparison, 3 years post-infection, those hospitalized for COVID-19 had experienced 90 lost years of healthy life per 1,000 persons. For context, in the U.S., heart disease and cancer each cause about 50 lost years of healthy life per 1,000 persons, while stroke contributes to 10 lost years of healthy life per 1,000 persons. Okay, let's back up and just summarize that a bit. So for people who weren't hospitalized but had a COVID infection in that first wave in 2020, 3 years later, they were suffering years of healthy life years lost. So this is not death, but a measure of disability. We're having health conditions that are impacting what you would call a healthy life year, that was comparable to the healthy life years that are lost from stroke, for instance, this year. And it's about 20% of each of cardiovascular heart disease and of cancer. So that is people that were infected in 2020 with COVID and were not hospitalized, they have a loss of the number of healthy life years that are equivalent to about 20% of what cancer is, or likewise 20% of what heart disease is, or about the same as what stroke causes in a given year. So again, not a small burden. COVID-19 is a serious threat to the long-term health and well-being of people and should not be trivialized. The extended trajectory for long COVID may change as researchers incorporate data from years beyond 2020. At that time, vaccines and antivirals had not been developed. Similarly, this analysis does not consider subsequent variants such as Omicron or Delta. Even 3 years out, you might have forgotten about COVID-19, but COVID-19 hasn't forgotten about you. People might think they're out of the woods because they had the virus and did not experience health problems. But 3 years after infection, the virus could still be wreaking havoc and causing disease or illness in the gut, lungs, or brain. So it is important to realize that this effect that I talked about in the story is for the people who would be unvaccinated and have no immunity when they got the virus. So we'd expect that this would drop substantially, probably at least in half. If you're talking about people who had a vaccination prior to the first infection. And of course, now people have had multiple infections. So each new infection is not necessarily going to cause the same amount of damage, but it does provide a little bit of an additional amount of damage with each infection. Yes, COVID-19 is a nasty virus and affects many, many systems in the body. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is, if you listen to the show for 1 year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And should that not be the case, I will gladly refund triple your money. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to those healthcare heroes during the COVID-19 pandemic and heroes still today, nurses. This from Stat News. What nurses really want, sufficient staffing for patient care. Pizza, coloring books, goodie bags. They could be activities at a five-year-old's birthday party, but they're not. These are many employers' attempts to lift the morale of nurses on the front lines of chronically understaffed organizations. What nurses really want are better working conditions so they can deliver the best care possible to their patients. As researchers at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, we asked thousands of nurses why they are leaving their profession. Their answers are straightforward. Short staffing is so rampant that the public health care is at risk. The playbook of corporate health care asks nurses to do much with little, but nurses aren't willing to skimp on quality and safety. There isn't a nursing shortage. It's nurses' refusal to be part of a system that puts profits before safety. In our study, which was published in JAMA Network Open, nurses from hospitals, primary care, nursing homes, and hospice told us they left their jobs because of burnout, insufficient staffing, and poor work-life balance. Close to half of all retired nurses had an unplanned retirement, suggesting many were leaving their careers early. Insufficient nurse staffing has contributed to a persistent cycle of burnout, driving turnover and vacancies. In the average U.S. hospital, 47% of nurses have high burnout, and some hospitals have rates as high as 66%. Healthcare executives admit these issues keep them up at night. Given evidence linking insufficient nursing care to preventable deaths, longer hospital stays, and avoidable readmissions. Evidence showed that nurse burnout can be eased by better working conditions. Stress balls and nurses' week's parties aren't going to change that. Nurses want serious solutions. Nurses beget nurses. Here's one intervention that nurses say would reduce burnout and stem their exodus. Make sure that enough registered nurses are at the bedside around the clock to care for patients safely. As one nurse in the study stated, "I would have worked another year or two if we had safe staffing ratios." It's surprising that executives in the nation's most nursing-intensive setting, hospitals, are not championing this leading evidence-based solution. With rare exceptions, hospital executives and industry groups have not only failed to promote safe staffing practices, but in Massachusetts, for example, have spent as much as $25 million opposing bills to set minimum staffing standards for patient safety. It's true that nursing services comprise a large portion of employers' budgets, about 30 to 40%. But having too few nurses on duty is costly to the bottom line, insurance payers, and patients. Opponents to safe staffing practices use fear tactics like the possibility of closing hospital units or turning away patients if hospitals have to follow strict staffing standards. But there is no evidence of compromised healthcare access in California, the only state with hospital-wide staffing standards. In fact, in states without staffing standards, hospitals are already closing down essential services, like birthing care, at unprecedented rates, in part because of challenges retaining healthcare workers. The public consistently ranks nurses as the most trusted profession and admires them as frontline heroes of healthcare. So it's remarkable that employers are able to exploit such valuable human capital with virtually no accountability to ensure that nurses are okay. As the largest payer of healthcare, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services could incentivize employers to protect their workers. Most U.S. systems receive payments from CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and are required to meet certain standards known as conditions of participation. These include reporting hospital performance on patient satisfaction and avoidable readmissions. By existing means, CMS could leverage its payer power and penalize systems with excessively high rates of nurse burnout. Patients would benefit from this transparency to make well-informed decisions about where they choose to receive their care. Patients' voices are powerful, especially since healthcare finances are affected by where consumers choose to get care. That is, if you get to be able to choose where you get your care. The public can demand hospital transparency in how much nursing care healthcare facilities have on their staffs. After all, nursing care is one of the most important factors on whether patients get to go home alive. In systems where business executives dominate the highest levels and where health professionals are in the minority, strategies to increase profits too often supersede a patient-first mission of delivering safe care. To be sure, there's a delicate tension that must be negotiated between sensible business strategy and healthcare ethics, but the current climate, which suffers from an overdominance of the former, needs to be righted with stronger clinician authority. Fewer than 1% of hospital trustee boards include a registered nurse. Given their expertise in patient-centered care, the C-suites of hospitals and healthcare systems need to include more nurses. Nurses often can't attend the pizza parties hosted by their employers in break rooms because they are too busy caring for their patients. It's time to keep them and their patients safe by making sure that hospitals have the nursing staffs they need. Amen to that.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, I have a few environmental stories, and this first one's a very interesting feedback loop and connection between cancer drugs and pollution. This from the Environmental Health Network. Cancer drug pollution threatens aquatic life and drinking water. As cancer rates rise globally, the increasing use of cancer drug poses significant environmental hazards, particularly for aquatic ecosystems and potentially drinking water. Cytostatic drugs using cancer treatment are not fully eliminated by wastewater systems, contaminating aquatic ecosystems. These contaminants harm fish, particularly affecting swim bladder function and thyroid hormone regulation, crucial for fish survival. There is a lack of comprehensive data to inform regulators, highlighting the need for further research in improved wastewater treatment. It is not beyond the realm of possibility to imagine a future feedback loop where the increased use of cancer-treating cytostatics themselves leads to increasing rates of cancer. Wow. Why this matters? The contamination of water bodies with cancer drugs could disrupt entire ecosystems and poses a potential risk to human health, especially children, if these drugs enter the drinking water supply. And next up, also from the Environmental Health Network, hidden pollution in European rivers from a forever chemical. A report reveals widespread contamination of European waters with trifluoroacetic acid, a persistent pollutant from the PFAS family. Water samples from 10 EU countries show high levels of trifluoroacetic acid, or TFA, in most rivers and aquifers. The French government aims to make the Seine swimmable by 2025, but TFA pollution presents new concerns. Experts warn about TFA's potential health impacts, including immune and reproductive system effects. This is without a doubt the most significant and widespread contamination of European surface and groundwater by a man-made chemical. Why this matters? TFA is a lesser-known but pervasive chemical contaminant in European rivers, posing health risks due to its persistence and potential toxicity. Addressing this pollution may require extensive measures, including possible bans on certain PFAS-related products. So, an interesting side story of this is Paris is trying to get ready for the Olympics and wants to do swimming in the Seine, and they're trying to deal with the bacteriological contamination, which is hard enough. But here we've got this single trifluoroacetic acid part of the PFAS family. Alone, the amount of that exceeds the total for PFAS that's considered allowable in EU regulations. Yikes. And next up, if you already weren't a big fan of tar sands, this is going to make it even worse. From Manga Bay, Canada oil tar sands air pollution 20 to 64 times worse than industry says study. The amount of air pollution coming from Canada's oil sands extraction is between 20 to 64 times higher than industry reported figures, according to a groundbreaking study. Researchers found the total amount of air pollution released from the oil sands is equal to all other human-caused air pollution sources in Canada combined. The Canadian government and Yale University study used aircraft-based sensors that captured real-time readings from a much wider range of pollutants than are usually measured by the oil sands industry, which is meeting its legal requirements under Canadian law. Of course, those legal requirements and regulations are often inadequate. The research adds to long-standing concerns by the region's indigenous communities over oil sands operations' impacts on health and the environment. The study also suggests potential blind spots in calculating emissions from other industrial activities, including various types of unconventional oil and gas production. Canada's oil sands are the fourth largest oil deposit on Earth and among the most energy-intensive to access and process. Buried beneath the boreal forests of northern Alberta, bitumen is a thick, heavy, tar-like form of petroleum that coats subsurface sand. It is extracted using both open pit and in-ground mining, which involves pumping steam underground. Current production is 3.3 million barrels per day. And, of course, our BP plant here in East Toledo, some years ago, invested several billion dollars in order to refit to be able to do the tar sands. Fortunately, a lot of that has gone down since it's very expensive to extract. And unfortunately, oil is still a lot cheaper from other sources, which is good for not producing the tar sands, but it's bad for the fact that we're going to be burning a lot more fossil fuels. Yikes. Cheap gas prices are not our friend, my friends. And lastly, I just wanted to do a story on our food system. This from Food Politics, Farm Bill Lobbying. Interest groups spent more than $523 million on farm bill issues between 2019 and 2023. Agribusiness spends more on lobbying than the gas or oil industries. And 561 different groups reported lobbying on farm bill issues. So, changing our food system, both in this country and worldwide, has to go against a lot of commercial interests that aren't necessarily aligned well with nutrition or public health. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. This week, 29 bonus articles. First up, study finds even low lead levels in U.S. water are linked to lead poisoning amongst susceptible people. So there really is no safe level of lead. And the susceptible people that's referred to in this article are people with chronic kidney disease, which is about 1 out of 7 Americans it's exacerbating their chronic kidney disease. Yes, lead is dangerous at all levels, so the more you can get out, the better. Bonus article 2, more evidence forever chemicals and other endocrine disruptors increase childhood obesity risk. So this was a well-designed study adding evidence to that suspected link. Bonus article 3, forever chemicals are found in the Great Lakes through air and rain. So this is just a good example of how interconnected the world is. It's not just through, rivers and groundwater, but they actually found that the concentration of forever chemicals was very similar in rain. Now in the air, it was more concentrated around, you know, heavy urban areas that have more pollution. But the rain, as it's all being mixed up and transferred across regions, actually is very similar. So it gets spread around. We are all connected, people. Bonus article 4, how 3M executives convinced the scientists that forever chemicals, the forever chemicals she found in human blood were safe. So this was a good example of a industry scientist being gaslit for their research and intimidated and convinced that it was okay when in fact it was not. A good historical perspective on big power in big corporations. Bonus article 5, a plastic recipe for societal suicide. We must determine which uses of plastic remain essential, eliminate those that aren't, and design new materials to replace still essential plastics. Yes, plastics is a huge public health problem. We're just beginning to learn about it, and it will be generations in the dealing with. Bonus article 6, Louisiana chemical plant threatens to shut down if EPA emissions deadline isn't relaxed. I love that headline. Well, go ahead and shut down. This Louisiana chemical plant is part of that chemical alley that communities have been fighting for generations. And they're not compliant, and this is one of the worst chemical plants. Threatening to shut down may be a gift. Bonus article 7. Farm workers face high-risk exposures to bird flu, but testing isn't reaching them. And a lot of that's because who are farm workers? Often they're undocumented folks who don't want to be interfacing with systems that might expose their vulnerability as undocumented. Also, in bird flu-related stories, bonus article 8, are pet dogs and cats the weak link in bird flu surveillance? So dogs and cats are the animals that are most closely intertwined with human beings. There are 10 billion livestock animals, 9 billion of them being birds each year slaughtered. Then obviously cattle and pigs and such. But cats have been found dead on the farms of these dairy farms. So cats have been exposed, and it can be a reservoir where the virus can change and then perhaps be transmitted to human beings. Something to look at. Bonus article 9, CDC asks states and cities to keep flu surveillance at peak levels because of bird flu threat. So they usually relax the flu surveillance during the summer when rates are lower, but it's CDC would like to keep that surveillance up because if we see a peak in flu off season, that could be a bird flu outbreak. Bonus article 10, move over wastewater, store-bought milk could be another way to track the bird flu outbreak in cows. So another story last week or two was that 20% of store-bought milk had detectable levels of bird flu particles in them. It's inactivated, so you don't need to worry about that unless you're drinking raw milk. But by doing analysis, either on the regular flu surveillance or this flu surveillance that could be through store-bought milk, can help detect changes in the bird flu virus. Bonus article 11, the chicken and egg problem of fighting another flu pandemic. Just another interesting factor is that much of our production of vaccines is related. You produce it using eggs. And of course, if we have a huge bird flu pandemic among birds, egg layers, you might not have the availability of the egg, so it's a chicken and egg problem. Bonus article 12, clues from bird flu's ground zero on dairy farms in the Texas Panhandle. Why did it take so long to recognize the virus on high-tech farms in the world's richest country? Good question, and a good case study to really get a nuanced view of the challenges of public health. Bonus article 13, what is pasteurization? A dairy expert explains how it protects against foodborne illnesses, including avian flu. Pasteurization of milk has been around for a long time, but it protects us from many, many foodborne illnesses. Bonus article 14, racial disparities in cognitive outcomes tied to early life experiences, education and segregation associated with cognitive disparities. So this is another social determinant of health. And by these early life experiences, You need to deal with those at the point of early life, not trying to give somebody some drug, 50, 60, 70 years later. And we need to deal with equality in education and segregation and racism. Bonus Article 15. Widespread disrespect and abuse in maternity care leaves mothers with lasting trauma. Just another report of the fact that, we may not give kids a good education in many cases, but often we don't even give the moms giving birth to the kids good care and suffer a lot of disrespect and abuse during maternity care, and that can be traumatizing. Bonus Article 16, stroke rates are rising, driven by the young. This is another example where we're seeing rates of death jumping up much faster among younger people. Overall death rates really start to accelerate over kind of age 60 or so. And stroke rates, still most of the stroke is happening in those ages, but we're seeing less and less health in younger populations and accelerating rates of many conditions in younger folks. Each successive generation seems to be getting more vulnerable and less healthy. Bonus Article 17. New data show the HPV vaccine prevents cancer in men too. Why don't more people get it? So the HPV vaccine is very effective. It's actually even more effective preventing cancer in men than women. And the cancer that we usually focus on is uterine cancer, but throat cancer is also even more common than uterine cancer, and it can affect men as well. So of course, both men and women getting the HPV vaccination protects each other, the entire population. That's the way it works. Bonus Article 18, your earbuds and you. What is all that listening doing to us? So there is sort of a, quote, silent epidemic of hearing loss. And using earbuds either at too high levels or too long can lead to hearing loss. And this article goes into detail about that and suggestions you can do to avoid hearing loss. Bonus Article 19, pedestrians may be twice as likely to be hit by electric or hybrid cars as gas ones. And this is largely because they are quieter. So pedestrians don't hear the car coming and bam. Bonus Article 20, deny, denounce, delay, the battle over the risk of ultra-processed foods. Big food is trying to dampen fears about the effects of industrially formulated substances. So a typical playbook of big corporations. Bonus Article 21, we must face down the expanding anti-reality industry. Exposing the anti-science playbook reveals the anti-regulatory motives of its deep-pocketed bankrollers. Yep. Bonus Article 22, study shows most doctors endorsing drugs on X are paid to do so. So those folks on Twitter that are endorsing drugs, they're typically getting paid to do so. Bonus Article 23, cancer victims sue Johnson & Johnson over fraudulent bankruptcies. So another way to avoid accountability for big corporations is they move the liabilities to different parts of the corporation and then have that part of the corporation declare bankruptcy. So some of the cancer victims are suing about that, quote, fraudulent bankruptcy. Bonus Article 24, imagine if the government offered dental care. New federal rule could give states the option for its ACA plans. So the Obamacare plans, if the state chooses, could offer dental care now. So that's a good expansion for those that are on ACA plans. Bonus Article 25, addressing healthcare workers' trauma can help fight burnout. So being a healthcare worker at all can be traumatic. You witness a lot of difficult things. And if you already are suffering from trauma, it can trigger that. So addressing that is particularly important for healthcare workers. Bonus Article 26. Amid mental health crisis, new compact allows social workers to practice across state lines for 14 states, including Ohio. So this is one of the weird things about the U.S., a very large country with 50 states, that in many cases has 50 different regulations for licensing different professions, and a lot of times there isn't a mutuality between those. So it makes it very difficult. And in an age of telehealth, when people are, for instance, going to counselors in one state and they move, they might have to give up that counselor or whatever, that type of thing. And just with a shortage of mental health care workers, it evens it out that people can access people outside of their own state. Bonus Article 27. More evidence backs active surveillance for low-risk prostate cancer. So rather than aggressively treating prostate cancer, you just actively surveil it, look at it, keep an eye on it, and that seems to be working very well and is a good choice for many people. Bonus Article 28. They bungled it. NIH documents reveal how $1.6 billion in long COVID initiative had failed so far to meet its goals. So, of course, government is slow, and long COVID is very complicated, and the biomedical sciences and medicine tends to be very siloed. And these are just some of the many reasons, but a good read to see the many challenges in addressing a complex issue like long COVID. And lastly, but not least, bonus article 29, poetry for rewilding the medical and health humanities. That's kind of, since I'm both a public health advocate and a poet, I'm a big fan of liberal arts educations and the humanities and how it can enrich medicine, health, and public health. So, hey, let us become Renaissance people. Life is more than biochemistry, my friends. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-